We've heard from Dr. Schwab during the workshop, but formally we'll introduce him now, Dr. Steve Schwab from Duke, who is going to let us know what we need to know about managing vascular access. And in the meantime, we're all going to take a course on what we need to know about how to get computers to work to project slides. All right, great. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. What I'm going to talk about today is hemodialysis vascular access, new solutions for old problems. And we're going to focus on AV access as we focused on venous access in the problem session. Permanent vascular access has three clear-cut criteria. It needs to be suitable for repetitive use, it needs to be capable of sustaining rapid blood flows, and it needs to have a limited complication rate. Our arterial venous access currently really do a very good job of number one and number two, but in truth, as I'll show you, only one of our vascular accesses succeeds in meeting the criteria number three, which is a limited complication rate. The first, and I would argue still the best form of permanent vascular access for dialysis, as we show you the data, is a native arterial venous fistula. This was first described as a cemino fistula created by the anastomosis of the radial artery with the cephalic vein, with the subsequent maturation of the fistula to be suitable for cannulation, so that you had a venous circuit that was all native with no synthetic material. An alternate that has been developed, primarily because of the inability to mature native arterial venous fistulas, is the AV graft. And an AV graft can best be described as a synthetic AV fistula. And what you see here is the artery graft anastomosis and the vein graft anastomosis bridged by a piece of synthetic tissue. Most commonly in the world, that's PTFE or polytetrafluoroethylene, manufactured by a series of manufacturers, both in the United States, Europe, and Asia. The third form of permanent vascular access, which in truth is more of a intermediate vascular access that we talked about briefly today, is the cuff-tunneled catheter. We won't spend much time talking about the cuff-tunneled catheter, except to show you that its patency and complication rates dramatically exceed those of arterial venous access when attempted to be used for permanent access, and its use as permanent access when there are any other options should be discouraged. The other thing we won't discuss extensively today is the use of the dialysis port. Ports are a new technology that has recently become available both on the North American and the European market. And I think that you should think of the port as a subcutaneous catheter with all the risks associated with catheters, with some additional benefits that may make it attractive for those patients who require permanent venous access. Most of the review of the material that I'm going to give you comes from the Dialysis Outcome Quality Initiative. And the reason I think the review of the literature should come from the DOQI is the single largest compilation of the literature that is yet available. To walk you through that, there were a total of 3,577 articles that were initially pulled for evaluation by the committee. Of those were read in abstract form by at least three members of the committee. As a result of that, 941 full text retrieval processes occurred, which means the actual paper was then retrieved from the world's literature and was read by at least three members of the committee. Following that, 221 of these papers were felt to be the key papers and were selected for what's called structured review. And structured review means these papers were categorized to a point and then were sent to a company that assisted the committee with guideline development so that statistical analysis of similar matched events could be performed. This didn't reach the statistical rigor of a meta-analysis, but certainly gave you the vigor of what's called a structured review. We ultimately cited 207 papers in the guidelines. When you look at the data in toto, and you basically ask questions about permanent vascular access, two things become readily available. When you're looking at AV access failure, AV access fails for two reasons. AV access fails because it thromboses or clots 92% of the time, and it fails because it gets infected 8% of the time. Literally the exact opposite of what you see with venous vascular access. If you basically say that thrombosis is the leading problem and you focus on thrombosis, you then learn from this same comprehensive literature review that 92% of these thromboses have what you believe is a clear-cut anatomic reason, that they aren't thrombosing because they're hypercoagulable, they're thrombosing because they have an anatomic venous stenosis. What you can see is of those that were anatomic, 99% of those were venous, were venous stenoses. Only 8% of the thromboses in the literature could be accounted for as not having a clear-cut anatomic cause. And these were important messages for not only the way we practice, but important messages for the development of future vascular access. AV access, 92% fail because they thrombose, 8% fail because they're infected. Of those thromboses, 92% had an anatomic cause, with the vast majority of those being in the venous outflow circuit, not in the arterial inflow circuit. Believe it or not, we didn't know that to this degree of certainty before 1997 when this occurred. If you look at a series of cumulative analysis of structured review, there's really three take-home graphs from the DOCI that sort of laid out the state of the art. And this is one of those. This is the DOCI primary patency state of the art. If you look at percent of all AV accesses without failure on the vertical axis, time and days, and this unfortunately is time and days from first cannulation on the horizontal axis, and you define primary patency as patency into the first event. The first event could be an angioplasty, could be a thrombosis. And then you look at AV fistulas in the solid line and AV grafts in the dotted line, certain things became readily and painstakingly apparent. That native AV fistulas that survived to become cannulated had an 800-day primary patency of around 73%. Actually quite good. In contrast, if you look at AV grafts, they're 20% at 800 days primary patency. And this is from the structured review of the manuscripts we talked about. So this was the world's literature as of 1997. If you then look at that same literature but a little differently, and you say we're going to look at the DOCI cumulative patency from this same huge data set, again, the graph is otherwise identical, the horizontal and vertical axis, fistulae is the solid line, AV graphs is the crosshatched line, but you define cumulative patency as patency reflects patency from initial cannulation to abandonment or removal of access. Okay? You see that AV grafts can be made to look better. The fistula line does not appreciably change over 800 days, but you see that the grafts can be repetitively repaired. And indeed, they rise from a 20% 800-day patency to almost a 45 to a 50% 800-day patency. So the good thing about grafts is they can be salvaged and repaired, and their cumulative patency is better than their primary patency. The other thing that struck the committee when this data was analyzed was we then looked at some 8 papers that were available at that time looking at DOCI cumulative patency with prospective intervention. And what these are, the 8 papers that basically looked at electively screening patients with AV grafts and not waiting for thromboses, but rather intervening the moment a surrogate threshold was met and then following them for long-term patency. And in those 8 studies in 1997, you can see that you can literally make these lines superimposable, suggesting that, at least with AV grafts, you could do repetitive interventions and improve their patency. And if you did it electively, where you didn't allow them to thrombose, you could dramatically improve their patency. Now, no one was suggesting that this made AV grafts the equivalent of AV fistulae, because the intervention rate to keep the grafts open was 6 to 8 times greater than the fistulae. What that simply means is that there were, on average, of 6 to 8 interventions per graft to try and reach that 800-day patency, where the typical fistula had no interventions to reach that 800-day patency. Thus, although you can make grafts better by aggressive monitoring and intervention, fistulae continue to be overwhelmingly better. And those were the 3 primary take-home messages from the entire DOCI guideline process. Having said that, the committee concluded that a wholesale return to native arterial venous fistulae was clearly in the best interest of the United States. And although the Europeans, at least the southern Europeans, have never totally abandoned AV fistulae, in the United States, the access and the ability of patients to receive end-stage renal disease therapy, the breaking down of the barriers in terms of age barriers, diabetes barriers, cardiac output barriers, allowed a massive entrance criteria with an increasingly use of AV grafts, we needed to look back and make aggressive efforts to increase the AV fistulae percentages. So what can we say about AV fistulae from what we learned from the DOCI guideline process? We can say that the advantages of AV fistulas, they have a very long patency. The advantage we can say is that once they mature, once they survive to cannulation, they have a low thrombosis rate. The other thing we can say is infection in general does not require removal. The disadvantages are is that many patients were unsuitable for radiocephalic fistulae. A study that was done shortly after the DOCI at the University of Alabama, where they tried to dramatically increase the number of seminal fistulas, showed a 70% failure rate, which means we were trying to achieve fistulae in large numbers of patients in whom we could not achieve fistulae. And the net result of that is we were requiring an enormous amount of catheter time trying to maintain fistula patency. The other problem was there's a relatively long maturation time in older diabetic patients. So although fistulae are clearly superior once they function, there's a huge cost in an older diabetic population trying to get them to function. As a result of that, changes were pushed away from Cimino fistulae with the belief that we could do better with upper arm fistulae in an aging diabetic population. And this is the work of Matthew Oliver. It's a large prospective observational study involving some 200 and some odd patients. And what this does is this looks at the thrombosis-free survival versus time and days from creation. Okay? And what it looks at here is thrombosis only. And it looks at a series of upper arm accesses. It looks at upper arm grafts. It looks at brachial cephalic fistulae, these. And it looks at brachial basilic transpositions, or those. And what it showed you was that, number one, that as you probably suspected, that if you look at thrombosis-free patency, and let's just select 500 days, you can see that your thrombosis-free patency for brachial cephalic fistula was tremendous. So if someone successfully matured a brachial cephalic fistula, they were in the 95% club for having that brachial cephalic fistula up and running. If you couldn't form a brachial cephalic fistula and you took a brachial basilic transposition, where you took the basilic vein and transposed it up over the anterior portion of the forearm, you got up around 72% 500-day thrombosis-free patencies. If you looked at the grafts that were placed simultaneously, your thrombosis-free patencies were around 50% at 500 days. So if you looked at thrombosis-free patency, this looks like a no-brainer, that we should be putting upper arm fistulae in almost everyone possible. Well, what you have to do then is you have to then say, how were the data analyzed? And if you remember the risk factors for grafts, the risk factors for grafts is failure after they've been put in. The risk factors for fistulae are failure to successfully mature to allow an initial cannulation. And if you look at not time from initial use, but if you analyze this same data from when the access was put in, what you do see there is what we call primary failure. Primary failure is the fistula never matures to use. And looking at this data the same way, what you see is exactly this. The brachial cephalic fistulae have an almost thrombosis-free survival once you put them in, but only roughly 68 to 69% of them matured to use. Okay? So of the brachial cephalic fistulae, only 68 to 69% matured to use, but those that matured to use worked great. If you look at the AV grafts, they matured roughly an 85% rate, but then had the predictable fall off we talked about. And the brachial basilic transpositions fell somewhere in between. Interestingly enough, the crossover point is roughly at 300 days, 1 year, 352 days. So we now have 2 and 3 year data, but what it says is that if you look at when you start trying to put a fistula or a graft in, you have the cost of the primary failures from the fistulae. And that after 1 year, the fistulae reap huge rewards. But these lines don't cross over until 1 year. So the primary failures accrue during that failure to mature period prevent the enormous successes that we showed you on patency-free survival. So failure to mature has an enormous impact on your cumulative patency if you analyze the data that way. So what does this tell you? This tells you that if you get patients referred early, before they actually need AV access, and you can try the AV access and have time to put another AV access in if it doesn't work, the risk to the patient is minimal. In contrast, if you get patients late and you get a primary failure, you're accruing catheter time every day that that fistula is waiting to mature or fails to mature. So we still need fistulae, but we have to understand that our fistulae success rate isn't going to really pay for us until roughly 1 year when the fistula graft line crosses. We now have data out to 2 years, and it's exactly what you think. At 2 years and 3 years, the fistulae look better and better, but in truth, you could argue the grafts are better in terms of 1 year patency when you factor in the primary failures. This just shows you that in this original prospective trial that we had suitable numbers of patients, and it gives you time to use in days. As you'd expect, you stuck the grafts a lot sooner. The brachial cephalics had the longest time period, and the brachial basilics were somewhere in between. So, we know a lot about AV fistulae, and AV fistulae that matures is hard to beat. It has a very high patency rate. It doesn't need much to keep it working. And I'll show you later that with prospective intervention, they really do remarkably well. The key factor is to get them to mature and get them early. And that's one of the principal focuses of the study I'll tell you about a little bit later, which is the NIH Dialysis Access Consortium. Well, in the United States, as a result of the things I've shown you, practice pattern changed in the 1970s and 80s to a higher reliance on AV grafts. And just to refresh your memory, the primary patency for grafts looks awful. The cumulative patencies look much better. And remember, grafts fail primarily because they thrombose. They thrombose from anatomic stenosis, and the anatomic stenosis are in the venous outflow tract. If you look at the location of the stenoses, they're mostly at the vein graft anastomosis. A small percentage are at the vein bifurcations, and a smaller percentage still were associated with central venous cannulation. When grafts did clot, there are really two techniques to resolve graft clotting. One technique to resolve graft clotting is just an honest thrombectomy, where you basically use a Fogarty embolectomy catheter to basically clear out the clot. The alternate approach, popularized with the use of a cross-catheter technique with either high-pressure saline or high-pressure lytic agents, followed then by treatment of the underlying stenosis, the fistula lysis techniques that have come into widespread use in the United States. But what you really want to know is there a downside to letting a fistula thrombose? In other words, what's the long-time survival of fistulae that thrombose versus fistulae that don't thrombose? Excuse me, grafts that thrombose. If you look at this data, and the first question you should ask is, what's the immediate success of thrombosis treatment? Well, I'm always suspicious of 100%, even when Gerald does it. So let's look at these three. But if you look at these three, Tarantola, a leading vascular interventional radiologist, Middlebrook the same, Bethard, the interventional nephrologist, all of them got in the mid-90s for opening up any graft that clotted to its next successful use. So the thrombolytic and the thrombectomy techniques are in the 95% club for opening a graft up and getting it to its next treatment. Okay? So if you're not getting in the 90s, then your people probably aren't meeting what we think are the national standards. That's immediate success. Well, what about long-term success? What happens long-term after a thrombosis and an angioplasty? Well, if you look at the intervention, a thrombosis plus a percutaneous angioplasty, or a thrombosis, if you look at a thrombosis without a percutaneous, If you look at percutaneous transitional angioplasty, or surgical revision, done prospectively, in other words, these grafts didn't clot, so there's no thrombosis, your outcome, when we analyzed the data, was roughly 50% at 6 months for PTA, and surgical revision was roughly 50% at 1 year. Okay? What this told you was that the process that led to the stenosis is ongoing, and that you can fix it, but that it's going to recur. But your recurrence rate is as follows. Angioplasty that was performed electively was, on average, good for 6 months before it had to be repeated again. Surgical revision, where you basically not only do the, where you basically bypass or do a patch graft, was good for a year. Again, the real estate theory is when you revise something, you extend it up further. What if you let them clot? The argument being that, well, if you let them clot, do you lose anything? Well, if you look, if you survey the literature, look at the differences. If you let someone clot and you do a thrombolysis plus transitional angioplasty, remember you get 95% initial success. I showed you the initial success rate. You're 40% at 3 months, okay? So here you're 50% at 6 months. Here you're 40% at 3 months. Your outcomes are really abysmal when you let someone clot. Surgical thrombectomy and revision after a clot, 50% at 6 months and 40% at 1 year. So clearly allowing someone to thrombose results in a bad outcome. And one of the questions that we couldn't answer is why. But if you look at these studies critically, what you come up with is you really do have a much higher, denser grade of outflow stenosis when someone progresses far enough to clot versus someone who just reaches a flow or a vascular access surrogate measurement criteria. So it appears that the more tense and the more tight the stenosis, the less amenable it is to intervention. And that really shouldn't come as a great surprise to any of us. But for those who argue, just let them clot and we'll fix them, I think the overwhelming weight of the evidence says that's not smart. Again, your cumulative patency with grafts and your cumulative patency when you intervene. Again, fistulas are clearly better because grafts are going to require 6 to 8 times the number of interventions. When you do a prospective intervention, this is what you see. Here's an AV graft cut coming up. There's an occluding blood pressure cuff here. What you have is a vein graft, you have a vein graft stenosis here with a post-stenotic dilatation. And post-angioplasty, you get this beautiful result. Now, what I'd like to tell you is this is what we used to call a representative experiment. Dr. Himmelfarb and I used to do experiments where you had representative experiment, but what really means is single best experiment ever. And I think that's what this is. This is what you call a perfect outcome to angioplasty. And the typical angioplasty doesn't restore 100% of the lumen. You consider it markedly successful when you restore 60 to 70% of the lumen. So you always lose something with every percutaneous intervention. So how should you monitor? Well, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on monitoring because I think surveillance is in evolution. One of the first techniques, because it was cheap and it was free, was a technique called venous dialysis pressure. And venous dialysis pressure simply operated on the theory that if the stenosis was close to the venous outflow tract, that if you monitored the pressure across the needles under very rigid conditions, that you could see differences as you developed an upstream occlusion. Fairly standard rheology. The problem with that is you had to standardize that for the size needles you were using. You had to standardize that at a relatively low blood flow rate, otherwise you'd just be reading pressure across the needles. You had to standardize that for the height of the arm and for the hematocrit, and as you can see, for the size of the needle. But if you did all those things, at least in the pre-EPO era, it was fairly predictive. But it was like everything else. It was garbage in, garbage out. So if you didn't carefully control for all these variables, it wasn't very predictive at all. Its overwhelming advantage was it was cheap. Subsequently, the technique has been improved by Besserab and colleagues to get rid of many of the variables by using static pressure. But I think the weight of the evidence is moving heavily in favor of using AV flow measurements as a means of monitoring AV access. And the principal technique is a thick flow dilution technique, and you can use any type of monitoring device. You can use ultrasound dilution, which is most widely used. Some of the new machines being manufactured use proprietary technology. It can be conductance dilution, it can be thermal dilution, it can be color indicator dilution. They're all basically thick principles, and what they fundamentally measure is a net flow subtracting out the contribution of flow up the access to flow through the access, and a certain series of guidelines have been worked out. AV access flows for grafts. When you flow under 600 mils per minute, some elegant studies done very early on by Thomas Detner showed that your likelihood of clotting when you reach 600 mils per minute was enormous. Subsequent studies have said, well, a lot of people clot well before 600 mils per minute, and what was shown was that a 25% flow reduction from peak, if you got less than 1,000 mils per minute, put you in extremely high risk for developing a thrombosis, and indeed put you in the 85% club for having a high-grade outflow stenosis. You must measure flow early during the dialysis treatment because as cardiac output flows, vascular access flows, and there's a series of variables that confound these access measurements when you're looking for a 25% difference. Nonetheless, the spot noise in the system, they're very predictive. The other thing that's been learned is that if you do an intervention and you don't restore the flow back toward normal, the intervention's been unsuccessful. So that the best predictor of how successful was your intervention is what's your flow after the intervention. So if someone dropped to 700, had a net intervention, and is still 700 3 days later, you really haven't accomplished anything, and indeed they're likely to clot. If you restore their flow back up to their 1,000 or 1,200, then you're much better off. What this shows you is a small prospective pilot trial, which gives you flows and then a series of patient follow-ups. If you look at AV graphs, which are shown here, you can see that you had flows on the average of roughly 1,200 mils per minute on newly placed AV grafts. It basically fell to roughly 700 at the time they were initially intervened upon. After intervention, the average came up to around 900 and then fell again and then continued to do that, but you developed diminishing returns with your AV grafts. So that, in general, once you developed a high-grade outflow stenosis, you could angioplasty it, restore your flow. On the average, as we showed you, 6 months later, you're back there again, you're angioplasting again, and your gains tend to be less and less. In contrast, what was striking from this study was not only that you predicted success by how well they responded to angioplasty, but that AV fistulae tended to be much more robust in their responses than AV grafts. Here's your initial AV fistulae, here's where they fell to prior to evaluation, here's their post, okay, so you can see it very good, and you'll see there's no additional thromboses mixed in here. What you can see is that the time after a successful angioplasty of the fistula to recurrence was greater than 14 months, and that's all the study could say, was it's greater than 14 months because there are so few second events. So, knowing all that, what's going on? Well, what's going on is venous stenosis. We now believe that this venous stenosis is caused by endothelial and fibromuscular hyperplasia in the venous wall. It occurs predominantly to vein graft anastomosis, but can occur in any area of turbulence. But there's got to be more to the story than that. There has to be more to the story than that because it requires an initial injury, but that initial area has to be turbulence. But if you look at turbulence along an AV graft circuit, you'll find that there are a lot of areas of turbulence, specifically the artery graft anastomosis, where you get almost no stenosis. In contrast, the arterial venous anastomosis, or the vein graft anastomosis, has a high incidence of stenosis. So it must not only be the turbulence or the injury, but it also has to be the response to injury. And the response to injury, we believe, is probably mitogen stimulated, and we believe the mitogen stimulation is somehow related to venipuncture. We believe that because vein graft stenosis occurs at a much slower rate in non-used grafts than in used grafts. So one can reason then it's not only the initial injury, it's the response to a mitogen, and the mitogen has something to do with venipuncture and the coagulation cascade that follows venipuncture. If you want to know what it looks like, this is an intravascular ultrasound picture of an outflow graft that's highly stenosed. You can see the venous wall is markedly thickened. This is the ultrasound catheter head in a markedly diminished vein graft anastomotic area, heavily calcified. You can see that when it grows to this level of occlusion, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that blowing up a balloon probably isn't going to have a big effect on this. This has gone to a certain extent that it's going to require surgical revision for a correction. So one of the issues that then come up is what could these mitogen stimuli be? And this is Dr. Himmelfarb's work. And what it shows you here is that fibromuscular dysplasia inhibition. And this looks at a combination of vascular smooth muscle cultures exposed to various stimuli to see what you can do to inhibit them. And I'll just call your attention to the first one. This is the control. This is the control group of cells. This is a PDGF exposure showing you that you have a significant exuberant proliferation. And what's impressive is that some substances, such as dipramadol, dramatically inhibit the ability of this to respond and cause fibromuscular dysplasia. Even when you expose it to this platelet-derived growth factor, which you get in the coagulation cascade after a thrombosis, dipramadol continues to be very effective. So one of the things that was very important is, rather than trying to react to this lesion, what we need to do is to find if there's some way to prevent this lesion from occurring in the first place. Can you use pharmacologic or other therapy that will inhibit this fibromuscular and endothelial hyperplasia? As a result of that, a consensus conference was held, and after the consensus conference, the National Institutes of Health formed the Dialysis Access Consortium. And the Dialysis Access Consortium is an NIH clinical multi-center trial of new techniques to attempt to inhibit fibromuscular dysplasia in AV access. There is a fistula and a graft trial completely underway. The design of the fistula and graft trial will be presented in abstract form at the American Society of Nephrology, and I encourage everyone to go by and look at those abstracts and see your tax dollars at work. Well, the next thing that we want to cover briefly is stents, okay? And the problem with stents is that they give beautiful pictures. If you basically look at what a stent does, this shows you, you know, a central venous problem that's been beautifully corrected by a combination of stents. You get an angioplasty and the stent seems to keep it open. The problem with that is that if you have an abnormal endothelial vascular bed and you slam a steel mitogen into it, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that you're going to develop pretty pictures, but it may even grow shut faster as a result of that steel being in the vascular bed than if the steel wasn't in the vascular bed. This is some of Gene Kovalik's work. And what Dr. Kovalik showed, at least with the stents we had available in 1998, that if you look at angioplasty in non-elastic lesions, and this is, we were getting patency in months, but at our center was better than the national reported patencies. We were getting roughly 12 months, but if you then stented those same non-elastic lesions, we not only didn't do as well, we did remarkably worse. In contrast, non-elastic lesions showed a slightly greater improvement with a stent, but elastic lesions only made up roughly 5% of the total. So in general, it is those reasons that stents have not emerged as being of much value in trying to keep our AV grafts open, because we have an abnormal vascular bed we're trying to put a stent in. We're really not dealing with atherosclerosis. Now, whether the self-eluting stents will make a big difference there, where we hope they will, is unclear. To date, we haven't gotten our hands on the self-eluting stents that release the FMD inhibitors. They have been used in the coronary trials, but have not come into us yet. So what are our future stenosis treatments? Well, you want to prevent it with new agents or materials, and if you're going to use stents, you want to make sure they're coated in some way to inhibit fibromuscular dysplasia. They can be coated with a self-eluting substance, such as sirolimus, that inhibits fibromuscular hyperplasia, or perhaps they can be irradiated. Those clinical trials have not come to fruition where we can see the results yet. In general, venous access, like we talked about this morning, has a 50% one-year patency. Losses are mostly secondary to infection. So AV access, even our worst graft, ends up being better than our best catheter. So in general, the point I'd like to make is that despite all the problems associated with arterial venous access, it's still substantially better than venous access. In summary, I'd like to tell you that AV access, which would be both AV fistula and AV grafts, are superior to venous access in patency and performance across every measurable performance category. AV access, both fistula and grafts, fail predominantly secondary to venous stenosis caused by fibromuscular dysplasia. AV fistulae have dramatically superior patency compared to AV grafts. The increased prevalence of AV fistula in the U.S. requires several things. It requires early nephrology referral, and it will require increased use of upper arm AV fistulas, such as brachiocephalics and transposed brachial basilics. And finally, if you're going to use grafts, I would argue that they need a prospective monitoring and intervention technique to get their best patency. Thank you.
We have time for one or two questions.
Do you do anything to determine whether someone, whether your patients qualify for an AV fistula, or do you simply leave that up to your surgeon?
That's a great question. The question is there anything you can do to see if the patient's suitable for an AV fistula? One of the things that looks most attractive right now is the concept of venous AV mapping. And there are a series of published techniques out there that suggest that if you map the veins, mostly looking at cross-sectional diameter of the vein and the artery, that you can select out who's suitable and who's not suitable. What we've learned is the vast majority of our patients are suitable for upper arm access. We've also learned that the skill of the person and the experience of the person doing the mapping is critically important to how valuable it is. But there are several well-published studies that show that mapping, a recent study from the University of Alabama suggests that mapping will allow you to dramatically improve your success frequency in where you try to form your fistula.
Steve, I have a question for you, if I can play devil's advocate, maybe that's why I'm here. There were two recent studies in AJKD, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the author's name, that looked at the risk of either developing or having worsening of LVH with an AV fistula. So my question to you then would be, given that if you intervene prophylactically with the Gore-Tex, A, do you know, are there data that look at the risk of left ventricular hypertrophy with Gore-Tex versus AV fistula? And B, if you have an AV fistula with a blood flow of over 1,000, but you really don't need that, should we be reducing it on purpose a little bit?
I think those are intriguing questions to which most of the data suggests that it's much less of a problem than you think. The reason, although you see this with AV grafts tend to erode their flow over time rather than gain flow over time, so you don't see nearly the same extent from AV grafts because they're constantly losing flow. AV fistulae, the best ones in contrast, either maintain their flows or sometimes actually increase their flows. My bias is that as long as you keep your flows under 15 to 1600, it just isn't that much of a problem. I think, yes, there is some risk, but I think if you look at the risk of the alternatives, yeah, which is the risk of either a venous access or an AV graft access, you're still much better off with that AV fistula. And if it gets too high, you can band it.
That's right.
But I would be careful banding fistulas because there's a failure rate associated with banding. So I would reserve banding for those people with symptoms who have flows well above 1,800.
Quick question.
Among the diabetic patients, what is the proportion suitable for AV fistula?
I guess in our experience, if you look at upper arm AV fistulae, if you look at brachiocephalics and transposed brachial basilics, we still think that at least 60 to 70% of your diabetics can get an upper arm fistula. We think in terms of Cimino fistulas, very, very few will mature a Cimino. And I think you're going to have to go to upper arm fistulae to get those fistulae patencies in your older diabetics.
Okay. Another question?
So I think that is a point in the difference between the United States and Europe in the rate of upper arm fistula created, because it reflects a ratio of diabetic patients, which of course you have much more diabetic patients, over 40%, and in some countries in Europe we have them even lower than 20%. And I think it's parallel to the higher, much higher upper arm fistulas created in the U.S. No?
I would agree. I think that one of the questions, one of the problems that we encounter is if you look at Asia and you look at Europe and the United States, you'll see that both Europe and Asia have much higher percentages of AV fistula than we do in the United States. And the reasons for that are unclear. American patients tend to be older, have more comorbidities, and tend to have a higher percentage of diabetes. Even after those are taken into account, we tend to form fistulae at a much lower rate than we should. And our suggestion is it reflects a failure of early referral and a failure of early attempts at fistulas, as well as a different patient population. So I would say it's probably multifactorial, but until we get our fistula population rate up around 40 to 50%, we probably still have things we need to do to get there. Thank you.